accession number 18802, reel 29.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 29.
I don't think there's anything more to say about that, really.
Well, that you proposed that Holland and Bull should get defence work, and they never did.
I'm not sure it got as far as a firm proposal. There was chat from time to time in the industry generally. Harlan and Wolff to us, Harlan and Wolff to the Department of Commerce, and, you know, the MOD came in on the act. But the general feeling was that, you know, they weren't in the main line of marine shipbuilding, of naval shipbuilding.
I mean, was it considered that there was a long-term prospect of continuation for
Holland Wolff?
Holland Wolff.
Yes, because, I mean, they've got a very, very modern yard, or it certainly was then. I mean, if not the most modern in the world in terms of how the ships were built. But, sadly, they were geared, and the whole sort of framework of the layout of the shipyard was geared to make big tankers. Very big tankers, you know, 30,000 tons and upwards. And, of course, the one thing the world didn't want at that particular moment was very big tankers. Oil, I mean, LPGs and LNGs, liquid natural gas as opposed to liquid petroleum gas, they were still required, but there was tremendous competition for them. And at that particular time, I think the Koreans probably were producing the best quotes. It had been the Japanese. I think at that particular moment, the Koreans were the most difficult opposition, and the Brazilians coming up fast. And so the question really was, could Harlan and Wolff match these prices? And the answer was they couldn't. And so, short term, it was all very difficult. I don't think anybody long term had thought to themselves, well, Harlan and Wolff won't exist. Because at that time, it was still a political requirement that they had to exist. You know, because one couldn't really visualize a Belfast without Harlan and Wolff.
What about Shorts? How are they doing?
Shorts had similar problems. I think Shorts were... I don't know so much about Shorts, to be honest. I mean, Harlan and Wolff I knew intimately. Shorts I got to know a little bit about. My recollection is that they weren't so overmanned as Harlan and Wolff, that they had rather more competitive tendering arrangements than Harlan and Wolff, and that probably the things they had available to market were more needed than the Harlan and Wolff products at that particular time. But, however, they both ran out of money in terms of running a private business. Now, under what circumstances... See, I left the Northern Ireland office in 1980. We're now in 1998, so it's all a long time ago. I think they both became denationalised, I mean, relatively recently, in the last few years. And I do not know, and you know, I just haven't kept in touch with them, I do not know the conditions under which they were refinanced or whatever happened to them when they came back into the private sector. But they both now are. And as far as I know, Harlan and Wolff order book is okay, and the Short order book is certainly okay, as far as I know. But they, of course, got taken over by Bombardier, didn't they, of Canada? Short Brothers, I think, again, a couple of years ago.
Now, one of the things that's sometimes done to assist ailing provinces is to encourage foreign investment. What were you doing there?
Yes, very much so. American in particular. And, of course... In Londonderry, we had, at Maydown, we had a big factory in the shape of, I can't remember the name of the big American company anyway. And there were two or three major investments of one sort or another, but every government I can think of since those days, and all the ministers of those governments and every civil servant who served those governments, all of them have been bending their minds towards getting inward investment. And as far as I'm aware, the record is quite good.
Were there any specific matters that came up under the exclusively social side of your division as opposed to the economic side?
No, I can't think of anything in particular. I think the agricultural side would be rather more so. There was a very strong man who was the permanent secretary of the Department of Agriculture in Northern Ireland, Danny, as it was known as. And he was a very tough character, and he couldn't be bothered with either Brussels or the Northern Ireland office at all. He was used to running things his way. And, you know, to an extent it was all very satisfactory. But one's driven back and back and back to the CAP on the one hand and the CFP on the other hand, and quotas, etc., etc., which has not been easy for Northern Ireland anymore than it has for anybody else on this side of the water.
Was there anything that you could do in your division to alleviate the effects on farming of those policies?
I don't think there was, because I think it was essentially a national problem which had to be sorted out with a national policy alongside the Brussels policy.
But presumably if you were thinking in terms of retraining redundant workers from traditional industries like farming or even shipbuilding, then there would be a specifically Northern Ireland approach to it, as there is to everything else.
Yes. Picking up the word retraining, I do not remember anything specific, under that heading.
But were you concerned with unemployment as a...
Very much so. Mm. And indeed, going back to my military time in Londonderry, I think I mentioned on one of the many reels before, that one of the things that upset, depressed, or whatever the right word is, all the soldiers who came through 8th Brigade, was the general feeling of... the feeling of unemployment as such is not quite the right way of describing it. The general feeling of helplessness, I think, amongst the population in Londonderry, about employment prospects. And, you know, I can think of particular street corners where not only did youngsters of today's unemployed congregate, but their fathers and their grandfathers had congregated on exactly the same street corners.
The hereditary unemployed.
Exactly. And, you know, it was all very sad. And so, I mean, I connect that up with the other question you've just asked. Unemployment was very much engraved on all our hearts as something we ought to do our level best to do something about. I mean, I forget the percentages now. I mean, at one stage, I think Northern Ireland unemployment was 19%.
But were you able to bring about any improvement in prospects in your 5 years in office there?
It was a joint effort with the Northern Ireland departments and the Northern Ireland office between them, trying to get inward investment on the one hand, trying to renew older factories on the other hand, and just generally aiming to do something about unemployment. But it's easy enough to declare that as an objective. It's jolly difficult to know quite how to tackle it.
Now, another difficulty from which Northern Ireland has often suffered has been emigration. The flight from the province by potentially unemployed people of marketable skills and qualities. Was that a matter of concern?
Funnily enough, it's not a subject I remember being discussed. But it's a very valid point, and indeed there were people who were going elsewhere, particularly to GB. But I don't remember it being discussed as a specific problem.
With regard to working methods, it seems to me that there are various ways in which decisions are reached in any large-scale organisation. Discussion on the telephone, informal face-to-face discussions, formal conferences, and correspondence, paperwork, and so a mixture of verbal and written means. And you've done this sort of thing both in the army at various levels and in the civil service. Was there any significant difference in the way in which the work was organised in that regard? The volumes of work done on paper as opposed to being done by telephone or face-to-face contact?
No, I don't think a significant difference. I mean, I suppose it's probably true that the civil service, and correctly in my view, tries to keep a more accurate record of what has been decided on a face-to-face basis or a telephone and so on, you know, office notes and aide memoir, etc., note for the record or whatever title you give it. And I was conscious of the fact that I inherited, when I took over the division in London, I'm conscious of the fact that I inherited from my predecessor, who'd been a Treasury man, some quite detailed notes about various conversations he'd had on different subjects. And I certainly am conscious of the fact I did not hand over to my successor a similar list of things and sort of volume of records and so on, mainly because I found myself more and more active, more and more busy, just keeping up with daily events. Now, if you asked me what daily events was I trying to keep up with, I would find it very difficult to explain. But the fact of the matter is that life seemed to go at a hell of a pace, and things needed to be decided very quickly when a problem came up. Again, if you said what problems in particular, I just can't remember particular ones. I mean, other than Harland and Wolff, which was always there and came up regularly as a problem for discussion at some committee or other, be it London or Brussels, I don't remember specific things, but life fairly cantered on.
Did you find that you were working harder, you were working longer hours, dealing with more paper in the civil service than you had been in the army?
I reckon that I worked harder in the Northern Ireland office than I'd ever worked in my life before, including the war. But I found it rejuvenating. And there was I, 50-something, 52, I think, when I went there, 51 or 52, whichever it was, and it was rejuvenating, without doubt.
What do you think it was that you found so stimulating? Was it just the pressure of work?
Or pressure on the one hand, yes. But then I'm one of those who enjoys pressure. And I respond to pressure rather better than I do to, you know, lack of pressure. And I think there are many people like that on the whole. I think many of us work better under pressure. Partly pressure, partly volume. You see, after all, we were trying to deal with all the Northern Ireland departments in quite some detail, in less detail, but on a sort of regular basis with all the Whitehall departments and with Brussels. Now, my entire team, I forget what our total strength was, but it certainly wasn't more than about 15. And that included me, and it included the typist. And so, you know, we were all quite pushed. And the interesting thing is, and I can't remember if I've touched on this before, but the interesting thing is the levels at which the young people in the Northern Ireland office were dealing with their opposite numbers in the Northern Ireland departments. Now, the structure of my division was me as an assistant secretary, three principals heading sections, with various HEOs under them. And because we were very tightly manned, and because the parliamentary questions flooded in, I mean, it was nothing unusual to get 20 parliamentary questions on a day, which I found extremely difficult to deal with, because I'm not skilled in parliamentary questions. And I always handed them on to the Under-Secretary when I possibly could, who very kindly, on the whole, did them. But all the detail work was done by these HEOs and the principals. But the HEOs, because of the layout at our end, were dealing with, I mean, I think of one in particular who were dealing with DSSS or Department of Education in Northern Ireland, Department of the Environment. An HEO would be dealing with two or three permanent secretaries over the other side, plus all their subordinate staffs. Now, initially, I think those permanent secretaries found it quite difficult to accept that they were going to have to deal with these people. But, you know, it was made quite clear to them that's how it had to be, and that's how it was. And, of course, from a training point of view, it was brilliant for these young men.
But they seem to me to be rather in the same sort of position as aide-de-camp in the 18th century sense, who would be attached to the staff of a commander and would carry his orders to his subordinates, who might be far superior to themselves.
Yes. I don't think it's quite that, because they were doing more than carry orders. They were actually providing original thought as well, and they were negotiating with individuals in the other departments, the Northern Ireland departments, and to an extent with Whitehall departments as well. And so, no, I don't think it's a fair comparison. I would merely say that these young men, some of them weren't all that young. In their 30s or whatever they were. But they were relatively junior, doing quality of work far beyond anything they would have expected in any other department. And that was extremely good for them. And good for the system, too.
It also seems to me that quite a lot of what you were doing, if you were putting together the demands of Brussels and Whitehall and transmitting them on to the Northern Ireland department, was something in the nature of what the military would call coordination.
Yes, but of course the other thing, we were responsible, our end, the cabinet briefing.
So you were representing your people in the Northern Ireland department.
Exactly.
Up the line of command, as
exactly.
It were.
Yeah.
Yes.
And cabinet briefs, be it full cabinet or cabinet committees, or indeed other ministerial meetings of various sorts, the original briefs had to come from the Northern Ireland Department itself. We had complete discretion as to whether we accepted the brief as it stood, or whether we tore it up and started again, or whether we just jigged it about a bit to send it to ministers. And so it was a joint responsibility, initially with the Northern Ireland Department, who, after all, the experts who knew what they were doing. And to that extent, we were coordinators. But having got it to a cabinet level, it became our responsibility to trade it, to put it through.
So you would have to understand it very thoroughly.
Absolutely.
If you were going to argue it.
Absolutely. And if you went to verbal briefing with the minister, it was your business rather than Northern Ireland Office business, or Northern Ireland Department business.
Were verbal briefings a frequent occurrence?
Yes. If you ask me how often, I couldn't say, but yes, quite certainly, verbal briefings were fairly regular. There was always written briefing as well.
But, I mean, how much notice would you be given normally of the requirement for a written or verbal briefing? Would it be a matter of days, or?
It'd be a matter of days, I would think, yes. Certainly not weeks. Might be a week.
Would these come down through the Cabinet Secretariat, through the Cabinet Office?
They would go to some central place in the Northern Ireland Office, whose name I forget, and would get fired out to the various divisions.
And presumably Northern Ireland Office would get them from Cabinet Office or Cabinet Secretariat.
Yes. Yeah.
You mentioned that, you know, you were there when the first Conservatives came in. Was there a major shift in policy or atmosphere that you could detect? when the government changed?
Labour had been there quite a long time, and indeed for the whole of the existence of the Northern Ireland office, so there was a sea change in many ways. I think it's fair to say that the the quality of the ministers, the Labour ministers, had been very high, and I think some of the Conservative ministers were a slightly unknown quantity. And indeed, the Secretary of State himself, I think, the one or two people who reckoned whether he was, wondered if he was a big enough man for the job, etc. And so there was a certain amount of unease, I think, amongst the staff. But that's a very general sort of reaction, and I suppose inevitable when you get a new lot you don't know a lot about. The only actual policy thing that I remember changing, which upset me no end, was, and I rather think she overplayed it, but this good lady I was talking about, who was the undersecretary to whom I reported, she took it upon herself to say that there is a dirty word that you must not use at all with this new lot, and that's industrial policy. Apparently they had said there was not to be an industrial policy or something. Now, in Northern Ireland terms, an industrial policy was actually very important. And, of course, I'd been brought up with it, with the previous lot. And so I was put out by this, and I wasn't quite sure how we were going to operate and achieve our objectives without such a policy. Anyway, that's by the way. To an extent, we went on as we'd been before, taking specifically industry on the one hand and agriculture on the other hand. We had a very good young man, well, not young man, but a very good junior minister in the shape of Giles Shaw, who quickly took over from Don Concannon, and as I mentioned on the Labour side, and quickly understood exactly what his business was. And I said to him, and no doubt other people said to him as well, you know, just look at your responsibilities, just think how lucky you are compared with other junior ministers in other departments, because there are you, responsible on the one hand for the Department of Commerce, on the one hand for the Department of Agriculture, and in between a pretty big input to Department of Finance and the Department of Manpower. And so, aren't you a lucky old thing, sort of thing, with all those responsibilities? And I think he took that point. But I don't think, other than the industrial policy thing, as a statement, I don't think I noticed a great difference.
How did it come about that you moved from the Northern Ireland office in 1980? Because you were not at retirement age for the civil service, were you?
No, I wasn't at all. And indeed, you know, I was sort of in line possibly again for promotion, which would have been a tremendous thing for a sort of a tame old brigadier suddenly to go through two promotions in the civil service. But they couldn't promise it, and people had changed. If it had been the original establishment officer, I think he would have done it. But he changed, and the new one didn't know me quite so well. And I think, and probably rightly, they wanted somebody who'd grown up in the system. And the chap who has got it was, in fact, somebody who worked for me originally in the original team. And I think probably it was right. Anyway, there was nothing firm about it, but, you know, I might or might not have been promoted, rather as it was in the army. However, and it's a ridiculous story, just shows where luck comes into this life. One of my HEOs in the Northern Ireland office had seen an advert for a job to be the deputy secretary of an outfit called Government Hospitality. And he said, what did I think about that, and would I put him forward for it? And so I said, yes, I will certainly put you forward for it. I can do better than that, I said, because I know the chap who runs it. I will ring him up and say roughly what I propose writing down about you. Is that right sort of thing? Is it what he wants? So I rang him up. This was a Tuesday in March 1980. And I said, look, this chap wants to apply for the job, and this is what I propose saying, etc. What do you think? And he said, well, it sounds all right to me. And I said, okay, well, when I've refined it a bit, I may need to ring you again. Well, he said, you'd better hurry up, because I'm retiring on Thursday, this being Tuesday. So I said, oh, well, give me the name of your successor, and I'll bother him or her instead. There isn't one, he said. And without pause for thought, I said, what about me? That being before midday. And by that afternoon, the head of the Home Civil Service was saying, what about him? Which was quite interesting, who knew me from before. And, you know, there's Ian, forget my own name next. Anyway, come back. But anyway, he was saying, what about him? And so, that being March, I then said to the Northern Ireland office, I said, well, do you mind if I do this? And they said, no, you know. The then permanent secretary, when he got to hear about this, said the fellow must be mad. He needs his head looking at, because it's a gut-worrying job, he said.
What, a government hospitality
firm? Yes. Now, he said all that. Stowe, his name was. And he said all that because he'd been the principal private secretary at number 10 when Mrs. Thatcher had come in, and apparently Mrs. Thatcher and Lord Carrington had been complaining like bilio about this lot. And Ken Stowe was aware of that. And if I had consulted him before I actually did anything about it, he would have advised me strongly against it. Anyway, I said, well, you know, thanks for the advice, but, you know, I'd like to do it. Not least because I can go on beyond 60. And so I then got interviewed by an undersecretary in the then Civil Service Department, who was the parent department for government hospitality. I then got interviewed by the chief clerk at the Foreign Office, because they have obviously a great interest in what happens with government hospitality. And they were dissatisfied with what had been going on with the present management. And one way and another, I then, by July, having got through various official groups, I fetched up in front of... I'd been through Paul Channon by that time, who was the minister immediately responsible for government hospitality, and he'd backed me. And I fetched up in front of Lord Carrington and Lord Soames, sitting on a sofa in the House of Lords, to be interviewed for this job.
What did they ask you?
The main question they put to me was, now, Brigadier Cowan, the premises in which we conduct our business, and they were referring particularly to Lancaster House, are absolutely wonderful. The wine cellar is superb. The food and its service is bloody awful. What are you going to do about it? That was roughly the question they asked of my remit for the whole business. Anyway, I think I answered it more or less satisfactorily. There was a short list of two of us, the other also being a military officer. We happened to meet at some place or other in the House of Lords, which I'm sure we shouldn't have done. Anyway, I luckily got it. I say luckily. Maybe it was right, or maybe it was lucky, maybe it wasn't. But anyway, I said to the Civil Service Department, I said, now look, as I understand it, I can go on to 65 without any doubt at all. I may care to go on to 70 or thereabouts. To which they said, they more or less said, look, if your face fits, because they'd had terrible trouble finding this a replacement for this other chap,